So I'm Alex, I'm 30, I live in Oxford with my wife Jane and our very cute six-month-old daughter. And my job, bizarrely, is to actually teach people to do these kind of talks, explaining Christianity to students, which may raise your expectations unrealistically high until you remember, if you can't do, then teach. So that's what I do.
Thanks. And have you always wanted to do this, or what was your dream when you were a kid?
When I was leaving primary school, I was one of three guys recommended into the local football circuit. And I knew then, if I'm number one or two or three out of the primary school, I'm probably in the top 11 of the country. So I worked out, if Pelé was doing his first World Cup in age 17, I worked out which was my first World Cup. So I had a personal crisis age about 14. But I enjoy doing this as well. So the title is Heaven, Hell, Eternal Life, Is Jesus the Only Way? Which is a massive topic, and I've got 18 minutes, so I embrace failure at the beginning. But let's see what we can think. So it's Friday afternoon, 3 weeks ago, and I'm cycling home in sunny Oxford. And I realise I need to call a friend and persuade her to nominate someone for this thing coming up. So I pick up the phone, I'm talking, and she's surprisingly quiet. And I'm rambling, la la la, spiel, ask the question, silence. And she says, Alex, I'm sorry, I can't quite process all this. I can't quite respond. It's not your fault, you didn't know, but I've just found out that one of my friends has died. I was like, I'm so sorry. She said, yeah, she was cycling and she was knocked over by a concrete lorry and was declared dead in hospital. It's this kind of our kind of age. You've ever had this kind of shock moments. You just don't know how to process, how to respond. And I didn't know who it was. She wouldn't tell me who it was. I cycled home, and I told my wife, and she was equally churned up. We didn't know who it was. I mean, she works for this church, but we know people who work for this church. You know, is it so-and-so? What about her husband? What about her kid? We were sincerely all kind of in pieces, and we thought, how are we going to find out? And of all places, we went on Facebook, and I scrolled down my news feed, and I saw this. And Susie, a friend of mine, says, remembering Joanna Braithwaite this evening and thinking and praying for her family, now she sees him face to face. What does that mean? Went into M&S to buy a sandwich once, and as I pushed open the glass door, I saw, reflected in the window, a familiar face, indistinct but clear. And I turned round, and there was my wife. She happened to be walking past with Lydia. Now, when Susie says, now she sees him face to face, she's actually quoting a bit of the Bible in 1 Corinthians 13, in which Paul describes the Christian experience of God now as like seeing in a reflective surface indistinctly, as opposed to the glorious technicolor reality of seeing God face to face through death. Now, why am I saying this? I'm saying this because half of that title is kind of fine. People don't have a problem with Christians believing in heaven. You know, a Christian funeral can often be, bizarrely, a sort of a hopeful occasion. That's not the problem. This is the problem. Next slide, please. Oh, and there is, yeah, there's Joanna with her glasses. So heaven is not the problem, but here's the problem. Yep, next slide. Sorry, mate. Cheers. So I read this, which is, it's called John's Gospel. It's John's biography of Jesus' life. And chapter 14, verse 6, Jesus says, I am the way and the truth and the life. And no one comes to the Father except through me. Now, the first time I read that, I was not a Christian. I'm not from a Christian background. I grew up in Somerset. Yay! And I was in my first year studying history at Oxford when a friend of my football team, still dreaming, a friend of my football team, who was a Christian, gave me a copy of this account of Jesus' life. It's like, great, kind, I like books, you know, I lend them out, I receive them. Didn't read it for 3 weeks until I had an essay crisis and was prevaricating. And it was the only thing that wasn't related to my topic. So I read it. And I thought I knew about Christianity, but I realized I didn't. And I was intrigued by who Jesus was and what he said until I came to this point, and here I choked. Because what he said here just, well, it annoyed me and offended me for two reasons. Firstly, it's just intolerant to say, I am the only way to the Father, the only way to God. I mean, come on, show a little bit of respect. Have you not heard of like other faiths, other religions? It's just intolerant. But that wasn't as bad as the second problem, which is just, it's frankly implausible. Think about it. In all of human history, how can one guy at one time, in one place, say, I am the way to God? No one else, no other way, it's just me. It's intolerant and it's frankly implausible. And it's those two issues which I hope to use the rest of the time to respond to. Firstly, issue of intolerance, and then secondly, and a bit more in depth, the issue of implausibility. So is it intolerant? So imagine being in Heathrow Terminal 4 in the security line, and you have a multicultural queue of people ahead of you, and you're bored. And this guy opens his mouth, some kind of Christian, and he says, hey, we're all sitting here, let me read you a bit from the Bible. And he says, Jesus says, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If I'm standing there, I'm going to be cringing. Because I can see these guys are not all Christians, fellow. And it would be entirely within the right of the Muslim guy standing in front of me to say, well, with all respect, let me give you an alternative. And maybe he had an English translation of the Quran, could read chapter 112, reading, say, he is God, the one and only, the eternal absolute. He begets not, nor is he begotten. And there is none like unto him. God does not have a son. You know, Allah alone is God. And Muhammad is his messenger. So you're standing there thinking, oh, this is just getting ugly. Typical religions, exclusive claims, they're going to hammer it out. Why do we have to deal with this? And to your relief, a third guy stands up and says, hey, I'm not from any faith. We all just want a quiet ride here. Can I just put this issue to bed by reading you a poem? He says, it's based on an ancient story, it has contemporary significance, and it was a poem written in the 19th century by John Godfrey Saxe. And he reads this poem. All right, you're stretching your imagination here, but bear with me. So he reads this poem. He says, it was six men of Indostan to learning much inclined, who went to see the elephant, though all of them were blind, that each by observation might satisfy his mind. And he tells, no, sorry, stay on that one, sorry. And he tells a story of how, you know, the guy who's got the tail says, wow, the elephant is really like a rope. And the one who's got his leg, oh, it's a bit like a tree trunk, etc. And they argue and they fight and they fall out, each grasping, as it were, part of the elephant. Poem goes on. And so these men of Hindustan disputed loud and long, each in his own opinion, exceeding stiff and strong, though each was partly in the right and all were in the wrong. So oft in theologic wars the disputants, I ween, rail on in utter ignorance of what each other mean, and prate about an elephant not one of them has been or seen. I think, wow, I'm like a bit of poetry reading in Heathrow. Has this put the issue to bed? And then, imagine a 10-year-old boy with a smart aleck twinkle in his eye raises his hand and says, Mr. Perm, can I ask you a question? Well, of course, go straight ahead. So what does this elephant represent? Represents God, ultimate reality, the way things really are. And these blind men, that represents their ignorance. That's right. And they're just arguing and arguing because they've only grasped part of the big picture. And the poet, is he blind? No, he can see. I mean, that's how he knows it's an elephant. And so the poet can see reality, God, how things really are. And do you see the point? Each of these religious guys are saying, we have reality. And the guy tells a poem and says, I have reality. He hasn't put the issue to bed. He's just jumped in and started fighting his own corner. It's not a kind of fun point to make, but it's unavoidable. An exclusive claim is not intolerant. It's inevitable. Because if we believe anything, someone else is going to disagree with us. And in fact, we tolerate those we disagree with. So when Jesus makes exclusive claims, he's not being intolerant, he's being inevitable. And if we disagree with him, we are doing just the same thing. We're all in the same boat. exclusive claims are not intolerant, they are inevitable. Given that, all we can do is weigh up these exclusive claims and try and see which is most plausible. What makes sense of my life? What is philosophically coherent? What is livable? Now, surely on this front, the plausibility issue, this is when Christians fall on their faces. Because how can, let's be honest, one man in one time, in one place, say, you can only get to God through me? Now, the reason, as a student in Oxford, I was ultimately persuaded this was immensely plausible was by what you might call the hermeneutics of courtesy, as in listening to someone on their own terms. And the terms that Jesus was describing were relational. Let me explain. So I'm going to approach this as a slightly unusual angle. I want you to imagine an ideal relationship. What's essential for an ideal relationship? I'll suggest three things. The first is a profound mutual understanding. The sense, you really know me, and I've seen the real you. Mutual understanding. Secondly, self-sacrificial love. Because in fact, any real love to someone is going to involve sacrifice. I'm going to have to give stuff up. I'm going to have to be orientated around you. Mutual understanding, self-sacrificial love, and thirdly, a secure future. Because no one wants a relationship that's going to end tomorrow. Has this got a secure future? Given those three, what I'm going to suggest that makes Jesus' claims plausible is that he is the only way to God, because only he is God making a way to us. Jesus is the only way to God because only he is God making his way to us, offering us this kind of ideal divine relationship with profound mutual understanding, self-sacrificial love, and a secure future. And the rest of this talk, for what time remains, I'm going to explain those three. Put up the next slide. There you go. And then one more. Because what's interesting about that chapter 14, verse 6, is the verse that follows. Verse 7, Jesus says, if you really know me, you will know my Father as well. From now on, you do know him and have seen him. If you want to know God, look at me. Let me explain these three. So, mutual understanding. And on forward again. And one more. Great. So, imagine you wanted to ask God, do you really understand me? How can he demonstrate that he does? Now, he could become sort of universal human with a capital H and transcend time, be ageless, transcend space and teleport about. He might look something like this. It's kind of a digitally created face. But if God was like this, a universal human, capital H, we'd have every right to say, no, you don't understand me at all. If you want to understand me in my life, you need to be born and go through birth in a specific place at a specific time. You need to experience growing up. You need to experience teenager stuff. You need to have friends who betray you. You need to endure suffering. You need to ultimately die. There's no way you understand me unless you actually live that kind of life. And you see my point? If God is going to demonstrate that he understands us, he has to be born in a specific time, in a specific place, and be a specific person. He communicates to us, we who are made in his hands, that he deeply understands us because he's become one of us. Mutual understanding is a possibility. Well, so maybe you do understand me, but do I know you? Hence, he comes in person, and we see him. And I'm quoting here from John's Gospel, John's biography of the Good News. You've got Mark's Gospel. I recommend if you haven't read it, you owe it to yourself to take it away and read it. If God appeared personally, what would he be like? What I'm always struck by is that whereas I'm tempted to be self-centered and self-serving, he is self-sacrificing. If you see Jesus' life, those on the outside who it's just not good to get involved with, like lepers, he takes their hand and heals them. And he gets condemned by the religious authorities because of hanging out with the wrong kind of crowd, but he loves them. There's mutual understanding. He understands us. He's lived our life. We can see him in person. There's a possibility of mutual understanding. If you want to know there is this mutual understanding, look at the life of Jesus. But what about self-sacrificial love? Now, as I said earlier, Jen and I had our first child, Lydia, back in May, the 4th of May. We're not Star Wars fans. What a waste. Some of you will get that. But what we found is that friends would say, hey, your parents now, how is it? You know, what's life like as a parent? And I'd say, hey, imagine incessant, tearful craving for sleep and food. That's me and Jane, and Lydia's even worse. Because the reality is that if you're loving someone with that kind of level of physical need, it's just, it's sacrificing. Inevitably it is. Jane gives up, I give up, sleep and social life. Because if we don't give up, she won't grow up. And if in 10 years' time Lydia says, hey, parents, you know, did he really love me in those early days? We'd say, hey, look at the photos, look at the bags under our eyes. You know, we used to have kind of color in our hair. Love involves self-sacrifice for those physically needy, for those emotionally needy. I don't know if you've ever had friends who just are quite wounded and quite needy. And if they say, do you really love me? You say, hey, no, I really enjoyed that four-hour phone call. Just look at the bill, yeah? Love involves sacrifice. What about someone who's problematic in their character, maybe manipulative or violent? If you're going to love them and get close, there's going to involve sacrifice. What am I saying? Well, I'm saying that if God offers this mutual understanding as we see Jesus live our kind of life, there's the profound challenge of realizing that he's different from us. He's self-sacrificing, we're self-centered. The life we live is always essentially self-serving. I walk into a room, and I don't think, how are these people doing? I think, what do they think about me? It's all about me. And what the former chaplain to the Queen, the late John Stott, said is that sin, the essence of sin, the human condition, is we have substituted ourselves for God. We've put ourselves, as it were, at the heart of the universe and assume everything revolves around us. Jesus is the opposite. He's the one who is self-sacrificing. So he writes, the essence of sin is we human beings substituting ourselves for God. Well, the essence of salvation is God substituting himself for us. We put ourselves where only God deserves to be, in the center of the universe. God puts himself where we deserve to be, and that is Jesus on the cross. That is him dying for the outworking, the consequences of all our self-serving manipulation of other people whom God loves. So Lydia says, how do we know, how do I know that you love me? And I say, hey, look at the photos. If we say to God, how do we know you love us? He says, this much. Self-sacrificial love shown on the cross. Finally, a secure future. Death mocks our happy ever after. Either Jane's going to bury me or I'm going to bury her. But if you read the biography of Jesus' life, John's, which I'm referring to here, you see that he is tortured and crucified and buried in chapter 19. And then you turn the page and you find that chapter 19 is not the last chapter. Death is not the final chapter. Not for him and not for us. If you read chapter 20, you see his friends go to the tomb, pay their respects, and are surprised to find it's empty. There's this empty tomb. And then he is seen by innumerable people, 500 at one point. There are eyewitnesses. And as a consequence of this, these original normal people like us are transformed and take their message out. And the early church expands. And ultimately, gospels like this are written and duplicated because of what's happening. I can't give all the evidence of the resurrection now, but we can do that in the Q&A afterwards. But as a history student, that was what convinced me this is real. Jesus stepped out of the fairy story onto the concrete of my life because he rose from the dead. There is a secure future. So to conclude, what I've suggested is that Jesus is the only way to enjoy this kind of relationship with God, because only he is God, having made his way to us. Communicating profoundly, there can be mutual understanding. He's lived our life. That he offers self-sacrificial love. He says, look at the cross. And that there is a secure future. Death is not the final chapter. Not for Joanne. Not for John Stott, who died. Not for me or you, who are here today. And I think Jesus' question to us, which is the final slide, Oh, thanks, mate, you followed it. It's this. Will you let me forgive you, be with you, and change you forever? That was the question I was posed as a student 10 years ago. And I think my first response was, no, this is just all new and weird, and I haven't thought about it, and I don't know what the implications are. Fine, fine. All I recommend you do is take away one of these accounts of Jesus' life and see for yourself. I was always impressed by Christians who didn't kind of try and hide their faith as if it was something embarrassed, as if it wasn't true. They thought, no, it is true. Have a look. Take it away. Have a look. So if you say, no, fine, have a look. Read about it. Ask questions. But if you think, yes, actually, I would like you, God, I know you, I've seen you, to forgive me, be with me, and change me forever. Then the prayer then, which is the kind of prayer I prayed, which was essentially, I'm sorry for this self-serving life that isn't the life you made me for and hasn't been great for those around me. But thank you that you do forgive me. Thank you that that self-sacrificial love is seen. And I pray, please help me now to live a life not oriented around me, but oriented around you. May Christ be my identity. May I be a Christian. So I kind of held out empty hands and prayed. And I think Joanna did too. That was intense. But thank you so much for listening. It's a tough topic. Hopefully I said something helpful. There should be innumerable questions in response. But I'm now going to hand back to Tom.